Hello and welcome once again to The Blueprint. This is Canada's Conservative Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Schmale, Member of Parliament for Halliburton, Kawartha, Lake Sprock, with new content for you every single Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We ask that you like, comment, subscribe, and share this program. Of course, if you can't watch or listen to it in its entirety, right this second, download it, listen to it on platforms like CastBox, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, you name it, it is out there. Great show lined up for you today. We are bringing in the man who set the record of filibuster time in committee. We have Rick Perkins. Thanks for joining us, Member of Parliament, South Shore St. Margaret's.
Great to be here, Jamie.
It's always a pleasure.
My voice is a little hoarse.
Yes, I don't blame you. So you were kind of filibustering the Finance Committee for good reason. Yeah. You wanted the Finance Minister to come to Parliament, come to committee, and talk about her multi-hundred-billion-dollar budget that she refused to talk to anybody about.
Yeah, I mean, the filibuster was really about ministerial accountability, a fairly fundamental thing of a Westminster parliamentary democracy. In fact, the open and accountable government document that the Prime Minister put out when he first got elected in 2015, and which is tied to every mandate letter, requires the ministers to go to parliamentary committees when asked. Unfortunately, the Minister of Finance, Chrystia Freeland, had not been at Finance Committee in the last 6 months and had actually blown off the three separate invitations from the committee to appear. One with the Governor of the Bank of Canada together or separately on inflation. The second one on estimates, which is almost a required appearance for a minister. And the third on, believe it or not, the pre-budget consultation. And those invitations were sent unanimously from the committee, from all parties, and the Minister of Finance never showed up. And that's why we were filibustering, because there was no belief that she would show again. And if she did, she was only willing to show up for an hour on a budget that projects in over the next 5 years that they will spend a record $3.1 trillion. We don't think it's too much to ask that the minister give Parliament 2 hours of her precious time.
She is busy doing all these important things like jet setting around. Someone did an attendance check on her. And was that you who looked at the attendance record back to January and figured out that she's only been to the House of Commons 3 times?
She had been 5 times.
Five times, okay.
Although
okay.
She had been in Ottawa 13 days. She only chose to show up to question period on 5 of them.
5 days.
Out of 48.
Five out of 48, wow.
That she showed up.
Almost as bad as Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, well, we're reminded, and I reminded Liberal members of a very famous debate, the debate of the 2011 election, where Jack Layton, as NDP leader, questioned then-Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff and said, you've got the worst attendance record in Parliament, and Canadians pay you a paycheck to show up to work like they have to. Maybe you should show up to work. And that's what we're asking for the minister, to show up to work. Maybe she was too embarrassed to defend her budget.
I would be if I tabled that budget.
Well, yeah, I mean, only 6 months ago, before she issued an economic update last fall. And that economic update, believe it or not, and you'll recall this, actually projected in 26-27 a balanced budget and a slight surplus. And 6 months later, she projects a budget that has nothing in the way of a balanced budget, and in fact adds $130 billion to the national debt in 6 months. Promised Parliament, and not unusual for the Liberals, promised Parliament to balance a budget 6 months ago, 6 months later, say, oops, sorry, didn't really mean that.
Well, they also said inflation was transitory, and we had worries about deflation, too,
right.
And we all know how that came up. So we finally found Freeland.
We did.
We finally found Freeland.
At one point, though, we were wondering if it was that we had to free Freeland.
Right.
Finding Freeland was our goal, but it was suggested at one point that maybe she wasn't being allowed to attend
that
by the Prime Minister's office to defend this terrible budget, this failed budget. So after we started to talk about freeing Freeland in the filibuster, we got an email to the committee clerk.
So saying, she was safe.
Saying that she would attend.
Okay, for an hour. Only.
No, she wouldn't say how much time.
Okay, in fact, well, she kept you hanging.
She kept us hanging. And so she finally did show up this past Tuesday.
That was kind of her.
It was kind of her. For 1 hour, and at the end of the 1 hour, she said, I can spare you another 15 minutes.
She's so generous.
She's very generous.
She spends us, what are we in this, $42 billion in the hole this year?
44 this year. And the first question was put to her by our colleague Adam Chambers. Very simple question. The question was, how much interest will we pay this year on the debt? Pretty simple question.
But you got to put that in context.
It's right. Yes. She said you had to put it in context. The simple answer is $47 billion. We will spend in Canada. I shouldn't say we.
But she didn't want to tell anybody.
But she didn't want to say it. $47 billion, it's a big number to pay in interest. It goes to bankers. Mm-hmm. So what's that equivalent to? That's equivalent to all the money the federal government sends to the provinces for health care. We spend as much on paying interest to bankers on the debt than we pay on health care to the provinces. So, and remember that our debt is now $1.2 trillion. And if you take Trudeau Senior, mm-hmm. who added $468 billion to our debt, and Junior, who's added more than $700 billion to our debt, $1.1 trillion of our debt has been added to Canada's payments requirement by father and son. Like father, like son. I guess sins of the father are the sins
well,
of the son.
Yeah, Trudeau Senior has started the ball rolling. But isn't that the kind of the leftist philosophy? We'll decry everyone else's wealth, but we want all of it.
Yeah.
So we decide what we spend it on because, of course, you know,
government knows best.
Clearly, it's not better for the people who are working for it, who are trying to eke out a living and maybe take a heck even a vacation to spend their money with. Right. Well, the simple pleasures in life, government should control it and tell you what to do.
Well, you know. Budgets do balance themselves, right?
They can, absolutely.
That's what was said in 2015.
It was that easy.
They would balance themselves. What that meant was that the government revenues would grow faster than their expenditures. And through that process, Justin Trudeau said, through that process, the budget will balance itself. And the reality is, when they got in power, they found spending much more attractive than worrying about, you know, your credit card payments. So they've been spending much, much faster than revenue comes in. Now, just to put that in perspective, when the Trudeau government was elected in 2015, the federal government was spending $263 billion, and the Harper government left that year a $1.9 billion surplus. Then they promised they would run some small deficits and balance the budget in 2019. And in 2019, instead of those it being balanced, they ran a $20 billion deficit. So what's all that mean? Well, the spending this year in the budget is almost $500 billion. So they've had a 63% increase in the amount that they spend since they were elected in 2015. And a budget projects the spending for the next 5 years as well. And it projects it based on the spending to date. That doesn't take into account what they may add into new spending next year or the year after if they're still in government. So if they don't spend a dollar more in new programs, and if you believe all their economic projections on interest rates and
inflation. Because it's been so credible so far.
Yeah, and their inflation numbers are very credible, right? They say that inflation will be down to 3.5% this year. For that to happen, inflation will have to be at 2% a year 2% a month starting in July.
Yeah, that's
not happening. We're over 4% now. Yeah. That's not happening. And so, and then it would stay at 2%. Now, how does inflation stay at 2% when they're imposing a carbon tax that next April is projected to go up 23%? So when you're increasing the carbon tax by 23%, which is a tax on everything, that by its nature causes inflation, in addition to everything else that's going on.
And we're still deficit spending.
Still deficit spending, so it didn't balance itself. So the spending has gone up 63% since they've been elected. Now, by the end of this five-year term, spending will have gone up 94%. 94%! Gone from $263 billion a year under Harper's last budget to over $500 billion. Now, if you think that they're just doing good things for people. Half the money that was spent during COVID was on non-COVID related
stuff. It was couched in the language of COVID so they could spend it, right?
And, you know, I'm sure the viewers know that everything is twice as good today as it was before, since we have twice as much spending. Our health care is twice as good. Our roads are twice as good. We're twice as fast at analyzing passports. And we're really efficient at processing immigration applications, which I think are up around
2.4 million now.
So while we've spent twice as much money, things haven't gotten twice as good for us. In fact, they've gotten worse. We know the doubling seems to be a habit of this government. So we know that one of the biggest thing that Canadians are experiencing is since they've come in, not only has the debt and spending doubled, but housing prices have doubled. The cost of a home and the cost of renting has doubled under these Liberals. So if you want to see the connection, it's pretty obvious.
As government also gets bigger, they've also hired a lot more bureaucrats.
80,000 more bureaucrats since 2015. It is the fastest growing employment sector, in my belief.
Which is incredible, because government itself, as you fill the kind of the middle management and the tower, not that the towers in Ottawa have anybody in them anyway, but their job really is to slow things down. They create the rules, the regulations, the red tape that slows down business, which needs to move fast to adapt to the current needs of their customer base.
I'll give you an example, just maybe make, because 80,000 is a lot of people. What are they doing? Where are those people being hired? I represent a rural fishing riding in Nova Scotia. I have 7,000 commercial fishermen in my riding. I said, so the Department of Fisheries and Oceans is critical to how we are able to earn a living in my community. Department of Fisheries and Oceans, in just the last 3 years, has grown by 5,000 people. So you say, well, that's only 5,000 of the 80,000. The department was only 10,000 people. Now it's 15,000 people in the last 3 years. And over 1,000 of those jobs went to HR and the finance department in Ottawa. So you never guess. Like, I worked most of my career in the private sector. Mm-hmm. We had every company has HR departments. But this is now a department of 15,000 people. Guess how many people work in HR, Department of Fisheries and Oceans?
Love for you to tell us.
832.
Holy smokes, you know,
they've got a lot of paychecks and stuff to manage with that fast growth of 5,000 people.
Yes.
So the finance section of DFO, combined with their corporate strategy, is now over 1,000 people in that department. 1,000 people pushing the finance papers of the 832 people in HR, because, of course, they need all those people in HR because they're hiring so many people. Somebody's got to do the paperwork to get them on board. It's unbelievable. It's this growth. And I can tell you, it hasn't gotten 5,000 more people better. In fact, it's worse.
We got poaching
and criminal activity happening in the fishery all over. During the strike, the police force for DFO, they have their own police force, is an essential service, but they refuse to go out in the water. Sorry, we're on strike. We're not going out in the water to enforce the law.
So, and guess what happened?
Guess what happened? Massive poaching. We've got thousands and thousands of poachers now illegally fishing seafood. And you may think, well, so what? But the reality is, the more people you have fishing it unabated, the more you destroy the fishery. You destroy our oceans. You destroy the biodiversity.
That's right.
Something apparently the Liberals claim to care
about. They claim.
But don't seem to do
anything. Which takes a long time to replenish if it's destroyed.
Now, I know I spoke for about an hour and a half on the fishery during this to educate my fellow committee members about where the money was being spent on this issue. But I think it's really important to understand on the issue. I mean, for a lot of people say, well, you know, isn't that a lot of silliness, what we were doing, right? Talking for 18 hours to get the minister to appear for 1 hour? It seems a little out of
proportion.
Well,
she didn't want to appear at all.
No.
So, yeah.
And we did get her, but she didn't answer the questions. As you said, when asked her that simple question on interest payments, she tried to explain to a parliamentarian how the budget works. She wouldn't answer. Let me explain to you how a budget works. It was very arrogant.
I'm not sure she knows. But she's not. It doesn't seem like they're being briefed. And if they are, they just don't care what the questions are. They've just decided, and we've seen this in question period, it doesn't matter what the question is. You ask them what color the sky is, they'll tell you what they had for dinner last night. Like, it's like they're not even trying anymore.
We were questioning this week in the House for a few hours the Minister of Housing. You know, we have a housing crisis in Canada. The government is spending $82 billion in their national housing strategy. And so I asked the Minister of Housing a very simple question. There is an estimate of how many houses need to be built in Canada for Canada to reach housing affordability, right? We've got a homelessness crisis going on. We've got a rent crisis. Mm-hmm. I asked the minister a simple question. How many houses need to be built for us to get to housing affordability and not be in a housing crisis?
I think Scotiabank said 1.8 million.
He accused me of playing politics in asking that question, because him being able to answer as a housing minister how many houses Canada needs to build is apparently a political question. I thought it was just a factual question. He didn't know. So I told him, obviously, he didn't know. And the president of CMHC was sitting there in the House, as you're allowed to do in Committee of the Whole, right beside
him. And they were handing sticky notes with some answers on them.
Little sticky notes. But I said, well, maybe you should get the president of CMHC to tell you, because the president of CMHC put out an annual report this year and said, we need 3.5 million new houses in Canada for us to reach housing affordability. And so I said, so how many new houses were built, according to Statistics Canada, in the last year? Again, he couldn't answer the question. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty simple one. Anyone who follows the housing knows that it's been plus or minus around this number for years, 221,000. So 221,000 new houses built in the last year, and we need 3.5 million. But he didn't know those two basic things, either that, or he just refused to answer because he'd be too embarrassed, obviously, to admit what a failure their housing policy is as part of this budget. So when a budget is spending $3.1 trillion over the next 5 years, $82 billion on housing, and you can't even cite the number of houses you need to build.
Yeah, but this government, they have two speeds, big government and bigger government. There is no, let's make way for the private sector to do what they do best. That's not part of how their brain works, it doesn't seem.
No, and if you read the mandate letter, so every minister gets a mandate letter from the prime minister and they release it. And there's one line that really I find quite humorous in every mandate letter, including the housing minister and the finance ministers. It's that you need to focus on the big ideas, right? To me,
right,
the big
government has the big ideas, right?
To me, 3.5 million houses so we don't have a housing crisis, that's a big idea. The solution, not so much a big idea. But apparently the little ideas don't matter. So the little ideas like processing a passport, you're not supposed to concentrate on those little ideas. You're not supposed to concentrate on the little ideas like processing an immigration application or processing the health checks for commercial pilots so that they can continue to fly. Those are the little things, right? The ante up at the poker game for the government to actually do its job. Don't worry about focusing on the little things. Just focus on the big things. But it's a government of inputs, not a government of outputs.
Yeah, but if they focused on the little things, it might make life a little bit better for the people paying the taxes that give the government the ability to run.
Right, and people's lives might be easier, better.
Maybe a little happier.
Might have a better paycheck.
Yes,
if they focused
would be nice.
On the little things. Those are the kind of things, you know, can I pay my rent? Can I pay my bills? Can I afford some food for my family? Can I save a little money for my kids' education? Those are the things that people worry about. But apparently those are the little ideas. They just worry about the big ideas. I'm not quite sure what the big ideas are.
We're still waiting.
I think one of them is a tax.
Probably. Well, carbon tax too is coming.
Yeah.
So that's
again,
going to, again.
And again.
Yes.
And again.
So we're going to be hit a whole bunch more times. The
41 cents a liter is their plan.
So they really want people out of their car.
Well,
they seem to really want people out of their cars.
Well, I think if you live in downtown Montreal or downtown Toronto, and you have the opportunity to take public transit, that might drive you out of your car onto public transit. But there is no public transit in my four-county riding. There is none. We have to drive everywhere. You have to drive for groceries. You have to drive to take your kids to school. You have to drive to take them to their activities. You have to go drive to see your parents. You have to drive to see your grandkids. There is no transit. There is no subway. There is no choice. So I have to pay the fuel charges.
Yeah, and in terms of the overall picture, I think government transportation is one piece of it. But I also look, too, at the fact that, you know, you spend, say, $400 on a car payment, right? That's not getting you much, right? Just basically getting you four wheels and a steering wheel. That's basically what's getting you. But at the end of that, you know, 5 year, 7 year, you still have something you own at the end of it, right? You buy a bus pass or a transit pass, in that 7 years, 5 years, you really don't own anything.
No.
Right? And so it's like they're trying to make that separation, make it so expensive for the average person to have a vehicle where they can go where they want, when they want, whom they want, rather than going, well, the train doesn't run at this time, I can't go, right? They're taking that away. I find it's kind of very interesting that that the government will not make the same sacrifices as the people will make, because they will still have their limousines, they will still have their planes. They get to go where they want to go, when they want to go, because they're super important.
Right, and most liberals represent an urban riding in Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. That's basically where their seats are. And so they really don't have an understanding of the country as a whole. They have an understanding, perhaps, to some extent, of the urban needs. But even in the urban needs, you're right. You know, you've got to go when the buses are running. Mm-hmm. You've got to go when the subway is running. And that isn't necessarily always meet your what
you need. Especially during the pandemic, what happened, right?
They told us to stay off. It's pretty hard to take your kids to hockey in Toronto on the subway and bus.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, you think your life's miserable now. Wait till you have to take the bus to take your kids.
You live in Scarborough and your kid's playing a hockey game in Mississauga. It's pretty hard to get there without a vehicle.
Yeah, I would say you have to plan a few hours ahead.
Yeah. And then you got to get home.
Yes, and then you have to get home.
Right? Yeah. So those are the things, the little things that they don't seem to concentrate on. So, you know, we just wanted to ask the Minister of Finance how she thinks spending record amounts of money will actually reduce inflation, because when you continue to put all this money, it's taxpayer money, but when you continue to borrow all this money and put it out there, what it does is it puts all this money out into the market, so there's more dollars chasing the same amount of goods, and when you have that, prices go up. It's simple grade 10 economics from high school, and which they seem to have some trouble grasping. And I don't believe their carbon tax works, because we have no choice. But if you buy the theory, then you understand that in order for it to work, it has to drive dramatically the price of everything up. Mm-hmm. Because it's the increase in cost that is supposed to change your behavior. So on the one hand, they've designed a tax that they say will only work if everything becomes more expensive. But it's not their fault that everything's becoming more expensive.
Exactly. Well, government should be here to maximize your freedoms, not control your behavior.
Exactly. Even right down to the type of vehicle, you know, they're mandating the end of the internal combustion engine. The internal combustion engine is much cleaner today than it was 10 years ago. It'll be much cleaner in another 10 years. Toyota is working on a zero emission internal combustion engine. Mercedes had a diesel engine with zero emissions, other than water. It was a little bit of water out in the diesel engine. We're there, but apparently the market isn't supposed to decide this.
Government does.
And in rural areas, even if you wanted to have some sort of electronic vehicle, there's no charging stations, there's no power to get you there. So a lot of folks in my riding that are interested in it are buying hybrids, but hybrids are not what the government wants.
No, it's not. No, they want to out-subsidize China and other countries, maybe even U.S. too, to pick winners and losers.
Well, they're
and they can't do that. We can't do that.
No, you can't do that, because government's got I can tell you, in my part of the world, government's got a really bad track record of picking business winners and losers. We had something called Sydney Steel for a while. We had we've had way back in the 1950s, a provincial government decided they would get into making stereos. That didn't work out very well. The provincial government in Nova Scotia thought in the 80s that the new latest thing would be an electronic toilet seat that would go up and down, and since you were there, and it would go up and down. So they invested taxpayer money in that. That went bankrupt. And a lot of people remember Brian Peckford, the premier, unfortunately a conservative premier of Newfoundland, who decided to think that that was a good thing to try and grow cucumbers in greenhouses in Newfoundland year-round and in the winter. And the first winter, the wind blew them apart. Because, you know, when you're on the ocean in the North Atlantic, it gets pretty windy in the winter. So governments really have a poor track record of picking mm-hmm. winners and losers. So there's a lot of
all
other examples. But they're doing that all the time. They're trying to do that in the auto industry now. They're trying to do that in sporadically.
The energy industry too?
Yeah. And they are allowing, while they do that, they're allowing a country with very hostile intentions towards Canada and to the West, for that matter, China, to buy up our assets. So if you really do believe in the green economy, you have to believe in critical minerals. Canada has one mine, one, that produces lithium. And the Liberal government in 2019 allowed it to be bought by the state-owned mining company of China. They own it. Mm-hmm. And 100% of the lithium, it's called the Tanco mine, of the lithium from that mine gets pulled out of the ground in Manitoba and shipped to China. Gets processed into cathodes and anodes for EV batteries and other things in the green economy. And then as our naive, Boy Scoutish Canadians that we are, we buy it all back at full retail.
Yes, so, while China's putting up more coal-fired power plants than ever.
Right.
Every single week.
Right.
Using that cheap energy.
The cheap energy. Yeah. And I know that the viewers will be surprised to learn that our number one export to China is thermal coal to help fuel those coal stations.
Oh,
so is that not a great green agenda?
That is wonderful. We're way over time. I could keep going on and on. My goodness, I hate to end it like this. All right, finish us off on an upbeat note here, Rick Perkins.
Well, the upbeat note is that as conservatives, we're listening. We hear what people are saying, and we're putting forward common sense policies that we're hearing from our communities and our constituents. So our focus is going to be squarely on those things that matter to people, and hopefully we'll have an election soon. We'll have a new prime minister under our leader, Pierre Poilievre, who will bring common sense policies to the common people so we can have more powerful paychecks and get the government out of the way so that the private sector and individuals can do what they do best, which is produce jobs and growth for our economy, improving our prosperity, which allows us to have all those programs that we
Absolutely.
Like. And so we'll be bringing home all of those great policies in the campaign that I think are going to be very popular, resonate, and show just how out of touch and these Liberals are, and how out of money Canadians are as a result of their policies.
Abundance equals peace.
Absolutely.
Abundance is the enemy of the Marxist.
It sure is.
And shortage equals strife, and that's what they like to do.
Socialism has been tried in a lot of countries, and it's failed 100% in every country.
It looks great on the brochure.
Yeah.
Put into practice, not so much. Yes, that's right. All right, Rick Perkins, thank you so much for having us, or coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Jamie, for having me. Look forward to it. Just keep paying attention, folks. Keep putting pressure on the Liberals because it does matter every time you call or put pressure on them on the mistakes that they make.
South Shore St. Margaret's is the riding. We appreciate his time. We appreciate your time as well. Please like, comment, subscribe, and share this program. We have new content every single Tuesday. We are not taking time off. We are continuing this trend because there is so much to talk about and more you need to know about because it's not being talked about in the mainstream media. Of course, tell your friends. They can download it, listen to it on platforms like CastBox, iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. Until next week, remember, low taxes, less government, more freedom. That's the blueprint.